Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. You're tuned in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. I'll be here with you again tomorrow night when we explore Weird America with my guests, Dana Matthews and Greg Newkirk. We'll be taking a look at some of the strange and twisted locations you can visit across the United States, along with some of their haunted objects and their haunted museum that they travel with. Adam Bolger will join us in the second part of tomorrow night's show as we talk about unexplained sleep deaths, the deaths that helped to inspire the iconic character known as Freddy Krueger. We just lost Wes Craven a few weeks ago, but we will be talking to Adam Bolger about some very, very strange deaths that occurred with no explanation. And again, that was the inspiration for the Nightmare on Elm Street series. Tonight, very excited to be joined by Scott Walter. Scott, of course, from H2's America Unearthed series. He has a brand new miniseries, which began airing tonight on the History Channel. It's called Pirate Treasures of the Knights Templar. The first two episodes aired tonight, but don't worry, you didn't miss your chance. Just go check out History Channel. You'll be able to find it on there and be able to watch the replays of the first two episodes. They'll be doing this for the next three Saturdays on the History Channel, so you can catch up. It's a six-episode miniseries. Fascinating topic. Plus, tonight, he has a new breakthrough regarding the famed Jesus ossuary. So we're going to deal with that in a little bit. And then later on in the show tonight, your chance to speak to the other side. We'll be joined by Dr. Elisa Medhus and channeler Kim Babcock. The brand new book, My Life After Death, A Memoir from Heaven. That's what we'll be discussing in the second part of tonight's show. Let's take a quick break so we can get right into it. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Scott Walter is the host of Discovery Channel's America Unearthed. While working his day job as a world-renowned forensic geologist, he's the president of the Minnesota-based American Petrographic Services. Scott began developing a new scientific process used to date and understand the origins of mysterious stone artifacts and sites. Now, the first artifact that Scott studied using this new science was the famous Kensington Runestone, which is right here in Minnesota. He believes it's an authentic pre-Columbian land claim carved here in America by none other than the Knights Templar. The Kensington Runestone was the subject of a documentary special called Holy Grail in America that aired on History back in 2009. And as I said, in America Unearthed on H2, Scott has a chance to use forensic geology and to explore many other untold stories in American history, changing everything we think we know about our past. His brand new six-part miniseries began airing tonight on the History Channel, Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar. Welcome to the show, Scott. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me again twice in a little over a week. This is great.
Yeah, it's great. We had you over on Darkness Radio. Now it's a chance to shine here on Coast to Coast. Your new series kicked off tonight. They're doing two episodes back-to-back every Saturday night. Is that right?
Right. Yep. For the next, well, tonight and the next 2 weeks. Yep.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about this series, Pirate Treasures of the Knights Templar. What can we expect to see in the new series? And do you have some really amazing new finds that happened during the series itself?
Well, yes. And, well, you know, it's funny. We worked on this show for about 6 months, and you never know how they're going to cut it all together. So I was really excited and, you know, a little nervous to hear how it all, or, you know, to see and hear how it all come together. And actually, I thought it was really good. And I thought Barry's stuff in Madagascar, you know, diving on the shipwrecks, pulling up artifacts was really good, and jumping back and forth between, you know, me going around and investigating things and his work underwater, it was really, really good. But at the end of the second episode, he found something that is amazing, and it's going to trigger me to go off in a different direction. And I can't say much about that, but it's really good stuff. It was some of the most interesting and fun things I've done in my whole life.
Well, you know, we've heard about pirates, and, you know, you've got the Blackbeards and the Redbeards and the so on and so forth going forward, right? You've got this. I've heard of the
Captain
Knights
Kidd,
Templar.
Don't forget about him.
You know, Captain Kidd. But I didn't know that there was Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar. Is that stuff that the Templars took away from the pirates? Is it something that was shipwrecked by them? Where does this story come about?
Well, I think the most important thing that came out of the show tonight that people need to change their thinking, that in 1307, when the Knights Templar were put down by, the King of France and the Pope at that time, you know, everybody seems to think that was the end of it. Well, it wasn't the end of it at all. In fact, from there on in Portugal, the Knights Templar there, who were very important to the country and to the King of Portugal, because they were the fighting force that were keeping the Moors that were attacking from the south at bay. So they weren't going to disband their fighting force. So to appease the Vatican, they basically just changed their name to the Order of Christ. But they continued on for another 500 years until they were finally officially disbanded in Portugal in 1835. So the whole point is the Knights Templar lasted another 500 years until the 1800s, all the way through the pirate age. So were there interactions between the Portuguese Templars and pirates? Absolutely. And who was robbing from who is really one of the big questions.
Very cool. Well, that's set into motion tonight. And again, I already checked, it's replaying quite a few times. So if you missed it, check out your DVR during the commercial break and set it so that you can catch up with the episodes. And it's on the History Channel this time. Six episodes, two airing every Saturday night between tonight and 2 weeks from now. So make sure that you're a part of that. I wanted to talk with you as well on the show. Something really I thought fascinating. There's all this story that came out quite a while ago about the fact that they may have found the family burial plot of the biblical Jesus. And there's all the speculation and stories going out and circulating about what it was, what wasn't it. There's some really interesting things that were chiseled onto these, what they call ossuaries, these bone boxes. And it really seems like they may have been onto something. Talk to us a little bit about the history. Where did this find come from? How did they locate it? And what's kind of been the history of it?
Well, the story really starts in 1980 when a construction company in southern Jerusalem, in about 2 miles from the Temple Mount, almost due south in the East Telpiat neighborhood, they were blasting the hillside in preparation for doing the foundation work for some apartment buildings, and they discovered a first century burial tomb. And these tombs are not rare in Jerusalem. They don't find them every day, but they come across them relatively frequently. And these were tombs of people who had money. And inside this particular tomb, they found 10 ossuaries. And I talked about the ossuaries on the show tonight, but they're boxes that the bones are put in after the deceased, whose body has been processed by only family members, is placed inside the tomb on a bench and left to decompose for 1 to 2 years. And then they collect the bones and put them inside these boxes. And then they put the boxes inside these tunnels that are cut off the corners of the burial tomb that's carved underground, and that's where these deceased are interred. And there were 10 ossuaries in this particular tomb, 7 of them inscribed with names. Now, I say there's 7 because there was one that went missing shortly after the discovery that didn't make it to the Israeli Antiquities Archives. That became a very controversial artifact. It's called the James Ossuary. And inscribed on it was James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And it's kind of a long, complicated story, but recently scientific testing, trace element analysis, confirmed that it came from this tomb, and it was the missing 10th ossuary. Now, that name, along with the 6 other names, which include Jesus, son of Joseph, Yosef, another Joseph name perhaps, Matthew, Maria, Judah, son of Jesus. That's obviously caused a lot of eyebrows to be raised. But the one that fascinates me the most is one that says in Greek, the rest are all carved in Aramaic, Mary Emne the Mara. Mary Emne is basically a pet name, if you will, for Mary Magdalene, found in the Acts of Philip. And the Mara is a title of honor, as in Lord, Master, or Queen. Now, if a person doesn't take notice of this group of names as being 100% consistent with the royal family, you're kidding yourself. And I have to say that myself, along with many other scholars, are convinced that this is indeed the family burial tomb of the biblical Jesus.
And for the skeptics, quite a few of them have pointed out the fact, well, you know, we all think, you know, Jesus is not really a name that's used everywhere, and certainly a lot of people are very careful with the use of it in their family. You know, but back then, Jesus, Joseph, Mary, those weren't far out names. Those were names everybody had. Many families used those over and over, right?
Well, that's true. That's true. But part of the problem when the skeptics and the opponents make their arguments, they say, well, that was a common name. And indeed, there have been about 25 ossuaries have been discovered over the years with the name Jesus carved on them. However, what they fail to tell you is in most cases, in fact, I think it's like 18 or 19 cases, over three quarters of the ossuaries with the name Jesus on them is not the name of the person in the box. It's a reference to Jesus, to the biblical Jesus. And most of them just simply say, Hail Yeshua or Hail Jesus. So that's not part of the data set when you're calculating the odds of this being that family. So when you strip away the false arguments, you get right down to the raw data and you calculate the odds. I mean, they're hundreds of thousands to one.
I thought what was fascinating when we talked about this before, one of your friends had likened this to the Beatles in the sense that Can you break that down? Because I thought that was a really great way to look at this when people are trying to say, well, but there are many families with similar names. Break it down again.
This is in a book written by Simca Jacobovici and James Tabor. And basically what they said was this is the equivalent of digging in, you know, the area of London where the Beatles were, first got together, and finding ossuaries with the name John, Paul, and George. And basically then you have, you know, this James ossuary suddenly becomes Ringo. Well, how can somebody not say that this is probably that famous band? And not only that, you have three more names. If they had three more members of the band, you got them too.
Right, so it'd be like, bringing up
an analogy.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, it could have been that just these people that were involved were very into the Beatles, so they named their kids this, but then you've got Stu Sutcliffe, you've got Brian Epstein, you've got George Martin, you've got all these other names that are attached to them. So it starts to limit the chances of this being just a random family that has similar names, because you're actually stretching it out.
Exactly. And then you have to talk about proximity. Where was this? This is in the area where you would expect to find them. And then there is another tomb that's right next to this other tomb that has not been fully studied. The ossuaries have not been removed, but they believe this could be Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. Now, is that a coincidence? I mean, the data, when you start to look at it scientifically, the consistencies here go beyond coincidence. And I think it's time that people, if you look at it pragmatically, you put faith aside and you just look at it for what it is. This is his tomb.
Talk to me about the fact that when they go in and they unearth something like this, if this is believed to be the biblical Jesus and people are starting to take notice of it, mm-hmm. as really being that, why has the government not clamped down or the Vatican stepped in and taken control of these ossuaries?
Well, the Vatican, what right do they have? I mean, the Vatican was basically created after Jesus was killed. And, you know, Paul took over and said, I'm going to be the new leader of the church. And, I mean, I think it would be very interesting if indeed there were bloodline descendants of Jesus and Mary that were alive today. And I don't think that's a stretch at all. In fact, I think it's probably the truth. But what if one of them who could prove it, that they were followed in the family line, and they said, hey, I want to take my right as the leader of the Christian church. What would the Vatican do then? Suddenly,
right.
they'd be in a lot of trouble, wouldn't they?
But that begs a lot of other strange questions, right? Because if you can find a human link and this happens, you should be able to then go back and start looking at the research. I mean, if there were remains, and you said in this ossuary there were still fragmented remains, some bones, some other things that were part of this, is there anything that's scientifically able to be broken down for DNA strands in these ossuaries that survived?
what I understand is, yes, they do have a partial DNA strand from both the Jesus and the Mary Magdalene ossuaries. And it turned out that they were not related by blood, which doesn't prove that they were married, but
right.
it'd be a little different if they were.
Wouldn't it be fascinating?
If there was a DNA match, that they were blood related.
And I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating if the biblical story is true and Jesus was, in fact, part man, part God, if you will, born unto a virgin, if we looked at the DNA of Joseph, who is, you know, the stepfather, if you will, and Mary, you would think then only the DNA would match Mary, not match with Joseph's DNA as well, right? I mean, wouldn't that kind of fly in the face of the religious aspect? And I think that could cause a lot of problems in the church if we did, in fact, match the DNA of Jesus to the parents that are there.
Well, absolutely. I think there's been some problems with that because the Israeli authorities cleaned out all the bones and basically reburied them in a mass grave, is my understanding. So what they found in the Jesus and Mary ossuaries were very small bone fragments. They actually found a lot of bone fragments, more than enough to do the work. But I don't know what the situation was with the other ossuaries. So I don't think that work has been done. But, yeah, it would be very interesting. And, I think you have to really be careful, Dave, when you start talking about this stuff. And I always want to make sure that people understand that, you know, me personally, I'm not on some crusade to try to usurp people's religion or people's faith. I'm trying to look at things scientifically. And so I always tell people, look, if we're going to have this discussion, let's define what we're talking about. If we're talking about science, that's one discussion. If you're talking about faith and religion, that's another discussion. You really can't mix the two. So I just want people to understand, I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm not trying to do anything to anybody. I'm just trying to understand what this all means and how it might relate to research that I've been doing for the past 15 years.
It's fascinating that something like this would still exist after all this time and that there wouldn't have been better documentation somewhere. It's heartbreaking to realize that the bones have been emptied out and just emptied into almost like a pauper's grave, right? Just like a mass grave where there was nothing kept. Did the people doing this not realize or read the ossuaries to realize what the story was that was unfolding in front of them? Or did they just not care?
Let's be honest here. We don't know what these people were thinking. But I personally, what my personal belief is that they knew exactly what they were dealing with. And I don't think any one of them wanted to be the ones that were going to make this discovery because they would have been concerned about their personal safety for good reason. In fact, one of the archaeologists who worked on the tomb who died a couple years after it was discovered, reportedly recently his wife said, he always denied that when he was alive. He denied that this could have been the tomb of the biblical Jesus. But his wife said recently, and this is just a rumor that I heard, that he told her that he always thought that this was that, but he wasn't going to go there while he was living. And I don't blame him. I don't blame him.
Well, right. I mean, it's something that can upset a lot of people by kind of shining a light on this scientifically. Although I think, don't you think in this day and age that miracle and science can coincide? Or Scott, do you just stand on more of the scientific principle of, you know, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, it's probably a duck. It doesn't have any other sidelines to that.
Well, in my line of work, there has to be hard, tangible evidence. Otherwise, it just, you know, I mean, again, like I said before, you can't mix the two. However, I'm not saying that there aren't some really strange things that happen in the world. As I've gotten older, I've come to realize that there are certain things in life that I'm just not going to know the answer to, that I cannot explain, and I just have to accept it. So that's a whole different thing. But when you're talking about this and about the other, you know, scientific stuff that I do on a daily basis, I have to stick with the facts and I have to go where the evidence takes me. And if I have what I believe to be enough evidence that's consistent with a conclusion, then I will say it. I will draw that conclusion. And I will draw that conclusion knowing that I may be called to testify in a court of law under oath, and if so, I'm more than prepared to do it. I've done it many times.
All right, we have to take a break. Scott Walter, his brand new miniseries, which began airing tonight on History Channel, is called Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar. When we return, we'll talk to Scott about a very fascinating find regarding the Jesus ossuary, something that he was able to see firsthand that really connects with the work that he's been doing. What is that find? You'll have to tune in to find out. Stay tuned. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Hey, I was contacted earlier. George Norrie, very excited. ParanormalDate.com is approaching 24,000 members now. 24,000 members, like-minded people interested in the supernatural and the paranormal. You wonder where you're going to meet that special friend or special person in your life? Well, George has put it together for you right at ParanormalDate.com. It's free to sign up, and if you decide you'd like to stay, you can get reduced rates to become a full-time member right there on the site. Plus, do you know that Hollywood is actually looking at this and turning it into a reality show? Very cool. Who knows? You may be one of the people involved in that as a member. So go check it out. And while we're talking about George, remember beyondbelief.com, George's TV show. You can watch Cosmic Disclosure with Corey Good on the Secret Space Program. That episode's up right now. Go check out beyondbelief.com. And you can find all the information on paranormaldate.com, on beyondbelief.com, and how to become a Coast Insider just by going to coasttocoastam.com. It's never been easier to sign up to be an insider. You sign up for a one-year membership. It's only 15 cents a day. It'll give you access to 5 years of past archives. It'll give you live chats, all the news, all the great stuff that'll be posted on the site, so you never miss another minute of the best in overnight talk radio. Treat yourself. Go check out the website right now, coasttocoastam.com. Hold tight. When we come back, Scott Walter will talk to us about an amazing find regarding the Jesus ossuary, something he saw for himself and how it ties into his work and research. We'll do that next right here on Coast to Coast AM. Scott Walter, my guest here for the first hour this evening, his brand new series, mini series on the History Channel, began airing tonight, Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar. Make sure you go check it out for upcoming airings of the show. It'll be airing this Saturday, next Saturday, and the following Saturday. Two episodes back-to-back each night, so you can go check that out. Right now, we're talking about the famed Jesus ossuary and how this actually, the new find, ties into the work that Scott's been so deeply involved in the last 15 years. All right, Scott, talk to me about this, and when did you see this? How did you see it? Was this a photograph, or did you see this firsthand?
Well, the symbol that you're talking about is actually two symbols. It's a monogram of two symbols that's on the lid of the Jesus ossuary. The box has, all the boxes have lids on them, and everybody was paying attention to the inscriptions carved on the boxes. And nobody had really paid much attention to this monogram that was carved on the lid. And the pictures were sent to me by a researcher, Charlie Pellegrino, who wrote the first book about the Telpiat tomb with Simca Jakubowicz. And he sent it to me because he had heard that I knew something about Masonic symbols and Templar symbols. And I looked at it, and they thought it was a star symbol. And when I looked at the pictures, I mean, I was floored. I could not believe what I was seeing. I saw the hooked X, which is a symbol that's found on the Kensington runestone, which is what launched me 15 years ago on this journey that has ended up with these TV shows. And I just couldn't believe it because the research that I had done starting with the runestone had led me to Jerusalem and through the Knights Templar. And to see that symbol on his ossuary, along with something called a Tau cross, which for those in the audience that know what the Egyptian Ankh symbol is, it's basically a Tau cross with the handle. That loop is the handle, and the rest is the Tau cross, which is a symbol of resurrection or restored life. And perfect to have on an ossuary, don't you think? And then a few months back, that was a year ago, and then about, I guess it's almost 6 months ago now, when we were in California on vacation, we went up to Los Angeles to see the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibition where the Jesus ossuary was on exhibit, and I saw that symbol with my own eyes. I got within 4 inches of it in front of the plastic, separator there, and It was amazing. It's just amazing. And I do believe it is directly connected with the Hooked X that's found on the Kensington Runestone and other artifacts and documents I found.
What does this tell you? I mean, when you look at this and you see all the other engravings, first of all, have they done any work on the engravings to date them to make sure that these weren't something that were chipped in after they were found?
No, they have not. That's work that I want to do, and I think I can help them with that. And I think I'm going to get that opportunity to do that work. We'll see in the coming months here, but you know, it fits perfectly in many ways with the research that I've been doing. And I like I said, I just could not believe it. It's still something that I wake up and I just go, I can't believe this is true. And when you look at it, it's absolutely unmistakable. And everybody that looked at it after me agreed and said, yeah, that's what it is. It's not a star symbol. Clearly it's not. It's a monogram of these two symbols. And for me, it just opens up a whole new chapter of research to try to figure out how did it get there, when did it get there, and how does it connect with the other Hooked X's that we found.
Just taking a skeptical approach to the images that appear on it, you know, I know there's a lot that's said, especially around the Egyptian hieroglyphs and things that appear to be UFO craft or flying creatures, things that just seem like they're aliens have visited us at some point, and, right. And they were telling the story. However, a lot of the researchers have found upon further research, what's actually gone on is that there was something there, and as a new ruler took over, a lot of times they etched over with a new design, they etched over with their story or their telling of that history. And sometimes these things are kind of layered over one another, which then creates something totally new and different. Could there be any chance that that's what you're looking at is, you know, if Jesus's family, obviously not a real wealthy family, could it be that they used a secondhand ossuary stone or something like that that could have had one image on it and they tried to erase and put another one to give this false image to make it look like something else accidentally?
Well, first of all, how do we know that his family wasn't wealthy? I understand that there's a lot that we think we know about the biblical Jesus from, you know, period documents and gospels and scripture and all that. But, you know, the one thing that I think people need to keep in mind that we know for sure, that certain parts of the Bible are not historical stories. They're allegorical stories. And there's code and there's ciphers. And there's a lot more going on in these documents. And sometimes the story that we think we're being told isn't the real story at all. So I think you have to be really careful about assumptions that you make about people like Jesus and his family. I mean, first of all, these tombs were not something that people would have unless they had wealth. They had to have money because they were expensive. And, you know, Joseph of Arimathea was well-to-do, and if this is indeed Jesus' tomb, he's right next door. So that assumption may not be correct. So that's the first thing. And as far as, you know, what do we know for sure, I think you have to go with the most parsimonious explanation, or Occam's razor, as it, if you will. The simplest explanation is probably the right one. And until you have evidence to suggest that this is not, you know, the ossuary that it says it is, I think you have to go with that. I mean, any skeptic can throw up any roadblock they want. They do it all the time. But, you know, if that's all we did all day long, then there would be no questions ever answered. I mean, you have to go with the primary evidence and wherever it leads. And in this case, as fantastic as it might be to some people, as unbelievable and disappointing as it might be for some people, I think it is what it is in this case. And let's move on from there.
One of our listeners, Annette, emailed me, and she said, the conflict for the Catholic Church is that church doctrine says that Jesus ascended to heaven and his mother, Mary, was assumed to have both body and soul, so there should be no bones anywhere. So to prove that these ossuaries are authentic would knock a huge cornerstone of the Catholic doctrine.
Well, that's true. But, you know, again, I said it earlier, we need to be very careful when we have this discussion. If you're talking about religion and faith, you can't talk about it in a pragmatic, scientific way. So for me, that church doctrine is it's a myth. I don't believe it to be true, and there's no evidence to support the fact that that happened. In fact, and now we have evidence that's in direct conflict with that story. So I'm sorry to say that the evidence just doesn't support the church doctrine.
Do you ever get nervous when you're doing this kind of research and you start to realize that what you're finding is not matching the popularized version, or in this fact, the religious version of the story? Do you ever worry about how it's going to come out on you, how it's going to be perceived? I mean, we've seen a lot of people that have, you know, done research and have come out against the story. Not that you're coming out against it in a negative way. You're just reporting the science of what you're finding.
Right.
I'm just curious if you're ever concerned for yourself with these finds.
No, I'm not. I'm not concerned at all. I mean, you know, I mean, if people need to look, it's 2015, and I think that in the case of the Roman Catholic Church, they've got a lot bigger problems to worry about than Scott Wolter. I mean, there are a lot of people that have been working on this tomb for many years, and I'm just picking up on a piece of the story that happens to connect with the research that I've been doing. And, you know, I've been working as a forensic scientist for 31 years. I've worked on some pretty amazing projects. I worked at the Pentagon after 9/11. And, you know, I've been called in to do some pretty sensitive things and things that were difficult. And this, to me, is just another interesting project. It does happen to touch some pretty big nerves with some people, and, you know, I can appreciate that. And as I said before, I'm not here to try to insult or offend anyone. I'm just trying to understand what's going on and how it connects with the historical information and artifacts that I've dealt with, if they connect at all. And as it right now, it looks like there is a connection, but it needs more work, and I'm going to continue to do that work. And I think the majority of people deep down are fascinated by this story. And even
right.
if it does conflict a little bit, you know, this whole idea of Jesus going to heaven, his soul could have risen to heaven. I mean, I don't know. Does that really make a difference? Does the body have to go too? Or can the soul go and you still have what many people, you know, believe to be what happened? I don't know. I think that's good enough, quite frankly.
I do. It's a fascinating way to look at it. And again, this, bringing up the science of it and to de-evolve a story and kind of get past the dogma of what it is to see what is real. I mean, it's still a fascinating find to locate a mass burial site like this where the ossuaries, the names all line up, and they come from the time era that would fit this family. It's just a remarkable find, and that you keep finding
everything
things.
Everything is consistent,
right?
And that's when you know you're on the right track. Everything fits, as it must, if this is the real story. And so far, so good.
I want to ask you another question. I mean, we're right on the heels of the tragedy of 9/11. The anniversary just passed a few days
yep.
ago. As a forensic geologist, you came into possession of some of the parts of the buildings. Is that right? Was it the New York buildings or the Pentagon?
No. I worked at the Pentagon. We worked on all the structural columns and beams that were impacted by the plane that hit the building, and we were asked to evaluate them for fire damage. Well, the original plan was to a surgical type of repair on those structural members. This one stays, this one gets repaired, this one gets torn out and replaced. And it turns out that the fire damage was severe enough that they changed the whole approach and said, based on these test results, we're going to tear the whole thing out and rebuild it. And that was the result of the work we did.
Now, there's a lot of speculation and a lot of skepticism that a plane actually hit the Pentagon. There's video footage. It doesn't seem to be conclusive in any way. A lot of people believe it was hit or struck by a missile instead, because it did hit a very intriguing part of the building that wiped out records that were a very important part of a story that was going on at that time. But you've done the research. You've actually seen and been around the parts. Do you believe that it was a missile, or do you believe a plane actually flew into the Pentagon?
I know it was a plane.
And how do you know? What specifically?
I've seen parts of the plane. I understand the damage. I understand why people were confused. And but make no mistake, it was a 767, and it hit the building. It penetrated through three of the five rings, and you know, again, I actually give a lecture about what happened and the structural members, the damage of the fire. There were pictures that I could not show that were given to me by one of the first responders, a member of FEMA and a good friend, Leo Titus, that I couldn't show for 5 years. And now I can show those parts to the plane that were in the wreckage. And it's gruesome stuff. It's sad, but it make no mistake, that was a plane.
One other thing, as a forensic geologist and understanding how heat affects rock and metal and that stuff, with all of the talk of the Twin Towers and the way they came down, how do you weigh in on that? You know, some people say that, it seems contrived, like there was bombs set into that building to drop the building because of the way they fell and because of the way the structures reacted. What do you make of that, and can you shed some light on it from a scientific perspective?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because let me just start by saying, first of all, I was not there, so I'm not speaking from a firsthand perspective. I was at the Pentagon, and I can tell you I know exactly what happened there, and I think I can explain where people get confused. I've done this to many people that were conspiracy people that believe that, and I love a good conspiracy, don't get me wrong, but in this case, that's a non-starter. But at the World Trade Center, there was a Smithsonian Institution documentary on the Smithsonian Channel that I just watched today, as a matter of fact, about the fact that the final report that was submitted about the attack omitted the fact that the aluminum, which was, I think they estimated it to be 30 tons worth of aluminum, that was the plane that ended up inside the middle of the building, was heated by the fire, and aluminum melts at a lower temperature than steel, and that it actually melted and dripped down to the floors where the sprinklers were in operation, and the minute it hit the water, it exploded. The aluminum, and we know that this happens, and those were the explosions that hundreds of witnesses said they heard, and, you know, people, conspiracy people have said they thought those were the bombs going off. Well, they were bombs, but there's an explanation for it, and the report that was published did not account for the aluminum that was, you know, blown into the building. They said it disintegrated. Well, it didn't disintegrate. I mean, it burned and it melted and then it exploded, according to the research that was done by these metallurgists. And I personally think they're right on. All the sense in the world to me.
And a lot of the complaint has been that jet fuel does not burn that hot, that it should damage it did. Okay.
Oh yes, it does. The it's not the temperature. The temperature, it can certainly reach the proper temperatures, but the problem is that when you have fireproofing over structural steel like that, it takes much longer. It takes several hours for the heat to build up inside the steel to the point where it loses its strength or its yield, and then it fails. And there just wasn't enough time for that. And now they think the reason that happened was because of this whole aluminum thing that was completely ignored in the final report. And I've worked with aluminum. I know exactly what they're talking about. And it's there have been many disasters with plants that deal with aluminum that came into contact with water. The molten aluminum will just explode. And I think, the plane went somewhere. It was inside the building. And you don't just take that matter and it just disappears and you don't account for it. There's 30 tons of aluminum there.
Wow, that's an interesting facet.
I was absolutely convinced by what I saw in that program and by the science they presented. I'm totally on board with that. And I think that answers a lot of the questions that people have about what happened at the towers.
All right. And, you know, my father's a construction worker. He's worked on buildings all over. And you know, there are buildings, like when you go to Vegas, they had started to build up a big part of the strip, and then it just nothing happened. And I asked my dad when we were out there, I said, well, are they going to just continue building on those? He said, no, at this point, they have to tear them down. When you've had the beams and concrete exposed to the elements like this, you know, even after a week, you've just suffered a major problem for all of the building and for the structure itself. And it can actually end up collapsing. So that could have a severe effect on it as well. Just interesting take on it. I wanted to at least bring that up because, you know, as Scott was just talking to us, that could very well explain what was going on with this as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll be joined by Alisa Medhus, MD. Her book, My Life After Death, A Memoir from Heaven. And remember, go watch the brand new series. It's called Pirate Treasure of the Knights Templar. Scott Walter, our guest. And that airs every Saturday night for the next 2 weeks. So check it out. We'll be back with more of the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM.